Welcome to the Scaling Tech Podcast, where we help you manage your growing engineering team. Through expert interviews, we help you navigate the challenges of leading, hiring, growing, and nurturing your tech team to deliver the value your customers demand. Brought to you by AgilityFeet.com, experts in staffing engineering teams in Latin America for clients globally.
Every external leader is like a meaningful risk for you, because external leaders, I think good ones, come in, listen, and like add. Bad ones come in and try to replace, right? And everyone's seen bad engineering leaders who come in, and there's like, you know, month one, they're like, these people are idiots here. Like, they don't know how to do software. Like, I'm gonna fix it. And there's like, step one, huge migration. Step two, bring in some friends. Like, step three, like, push out the existing leadership structure. And like a year later, it's just like in shambles. And then it's like, it's because the previous people sucked that it's not working. There's not like a ton of self-awareness on it. I mean, the reality is being an executive doesn't really reward self-awareness, because then you'd be responsible and accountable for like your underperformance instead of being able to blame someone else, right? So this is like the nightmare scenario.
Welcome to the Scaling Tech Podcast, the podcast for leaders of growing software engineering teams. I'm Aaron Syme, here with my co-host, David Alfaro. How are you doing today, David?
Doing fine. I'm getting ready for the weekend. All good here, Costa Rica.
Excellent. Excellent. We have a lot of things to think about over the weekend, because we just had a really good conversation in today's episode. I'm really excited that we were able to speak with Will Larson, a highly respected author of the engineering management books, An Elegant Puzzle and Staff Engineer. What did you think of our conversation today with Will?
Well, it was very relevant to our business, because, I mean, mm-hmm. we've been providing software engineers for American companies and the software engineers in remote locations. Remote software engineers in Latin America, but we have been doing this for the last 12 years. And 12 years means that we had seen people growing, and being promoted. And becoming leaders, that is a wonderful thing to see, but still has challenges. I mean, how you deal with a situation when someone wants to be better paid, and now it is already a senior software engineer. So what's the next step? How you have that conversation, and why is so important? What is the role of a staff engineer or a staff management person? So those topics are quite important. And in our audience, all the people that we have in our audience that are software engineers, this is going to be a very valuable episode for you as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that distinction that Will draws in his book, Staff Engineer, about the different paths you can take of a more traditional engineering management type of role versus a growth as an engineer into that staff engineer, principal engineer, distinguished engineer. I think it's really interesting, and as you said, it's definitely important for an organization like ours, where we're working with our clients. So our team members do need to grow in compensation and as well as just kind of their sense of value and the titles that demonstrate that. I think that Staff Engineer book really covers a lot of that really well. It's very interesting. And then also, just as any organization, including ours, grows, you also need more perhaps traditional, let's say, type of engineering managers organizing teams and handling all of that work. And Will's book, An Elegant Puzzle, has a lot of really interesting tips in that. It's a book that I certainly wish I had 15 years ago. Would have been really beneficial to me. To be able to tap into Will's experience as we were able to in this conversation was just really fantastic. Really enjoyed it. So let's get to our conversation with Will Larson. Will Larson has been a software engineering leader at Calm, Stripe, Uber, and Dig. He's the author of An Elegant Puzzle and Staff Engineer. Before moving to San Francisco, he grew up in North Carolina and studied computer science at Centre College in Kentucky. Will's books cover all sorts of challenges that engineering managers face, from how to size your teams to managing technical debt to hiring and even replacing yourself. They're a very good read, and yet not filled with fluff and filler stories. Instead, they're full of clear explanations, actionable advice, make a great reference to keep at your own desk as well as to give to other managers on your team. Welcome so much to the Scaling Tech Podcast, Will.
Thank you so much. I'm super excited to be here, share a little bit of the kind of perspective behind some of my writing and just, you know, have a great conversation.
No, we are as well. Really appreciate you taking the time. We've both really enjoyed reading your books. I want to start with just asking you a little bit about why is engineering management so self-taught? How did you learn it? How did you come into that space?
It's a great question. And I think a lot of the profession on engineering is self-taught as well. We certainly go to college in many cases and you learn computer science, but then you see what you study and what you do don't overlap that much between software engineering and computer science, right? Even more true for the management side of things. And so for me, the reason I got into management is that just that's where all the interesting problems were. And when I first started out the first couple of years, I thought, you know, all the interesting problems are going to be technical and, you know, people working together is the easy part. As I got further into it, it just became clear it's really the opposite for most companies. There are companies doing hard, complex, deep technical work. The vast majority of companies, though, the hard part is getting people moving in the same direction and doing reasonable things at a reasonable pace. And so to me, that's where I got really excited about the people management side, not because I thought the technology is boring, but it's just like, man, I want to improve things. I want to make progress. And here's the solution to most of the problems that I'm running into. And I think to your point about why is there not more of like a structured way to learn, there really should be like a structured way to learn. But I do think the managers I've seen most effective in technology have been technologists first and then moved over. And so I think that structurally makes it a little bit complicated. I think like in theory, like the MBA is supposed to be something that would help people make a transition like this in other professions. But I've never seen it apply particularly well to the engineering track.
Yeah, I agree. I think David and I, like most of us are, you know, we're self-taught on the management side initially at least. And I tell a story in our very first episode of the Scaling Tech Podcast, where David and I kind of share more about our background, about my first experience as an engineering manager. And it was, you know, leading what was essentially a death march project. It was a terrible introduction to management. I did not enjoy it. My team did not enjoy it. And at the end of it, I was definitely questioning my own ambitions and aspirations. Do I really want to do this for a living? If every, you know, managing every project is going to be such a miserable process, right? So that definitely started me on a journey of learning agile management methodologies, helped, you know, improve that a lot, ended up going back and getting a master's in management and IT, which was, you know, like an MBA, but more focused on technology management, which was helpful. But ultimately, it's still really all so much of it is self-taught. So that's certainly something I appreciated about your books was the advice in that for so many scenarios that we encountered that, you know, none of those other learning opportunities I had at least really covered to the same degree.
But also it's taking me to something that up until now I haven't considered from a introspection of point of view is that, as in my case, and I think that was the same for you, Erin, is that
right.
I didn't have a mentor. So I was thrown to the pool and I had to find my way out to the out of it. And I would have, and the more I think of it is my organization didn't have the willingness to mentor anyone to become a leader. And I was very ambitious to become a leader in my team, and I had to find my way to it. And the other problem I'm thinking is, none of the potential mentors that we had at the company at the time were good role models for me. I think that they would have taught me biases. Ways to do things in an incorrect way. So, can you explore that?
I think that's a really important and really interesting question, right? Like, I think you are right that particularly in smaller companies, most of the leadership there are also self-taught, and they're self-taught from often like a pretty small sample size of experiences where maybe they've been at this one startup or this one small company for a decade, and that's your only management experience. And then you come in and you want to learn, but how do you learn from them? Like they have just this one specific set of circumstances, and they often assume that's how everything works. But actually, from my first book, An Elegant Puzzle, like one of the most interesting pieces of feedback I got from folks were people who were frustrated that it was over-indexed on kind of this Silicon Valley-ism, right? This is like how a scale-up works in Silicon Valley. But it didn't reflect their experience, you know, starting a startup in like the Research Triangle in North Carolina or kind of elsewhere. And they're like, hey, this is not universal like you say it is. And, you know, all books like run the risk of like overrepresenting like what they say. But I do think it's more than just the book. Finding mentors has been really challenging. And personally, I basically ended up not relying on mentors in my career because they've been so hard to find high quality ones. And I think that continues to be true. But I used to think this was a problem because I was at small companies initially. I was at Yahoo, which is a huge company, but I wasn't managing at that point. Then came into Dig, and there were very few experienced managers left, you know, after we did a couple rounds of layoffs. But even people who can't like come up in big companies, like people who like come of age as leaders in Google or Amazon or whatnot, I don't think they're getting great mentorship either. And so I think it's more than just company size. I think it's like actually like a real like lack of mentorship anywhere, even if the companies theoretically have the capacity to do it.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting point. And I think it's, in my experience at least, and I think I've you know, failed as in this way as an engineering manager before, it's cyclical too, right? When you're in the period of a reorganization, a downsizing, or at the other end of a dramatic scaling up, those are times where it's very easy to forget about doing things like mentoring your team and growing them and paying attention to their needs, because, you know, in one direction or the other, you're in a sort of survival mode.
I think something really interesting happening in the industry right now is that there's been this decade of kind of people-oriented management. And you're seeing this shift towards, I would say, like capital-oriented management or outcome-oriented management. And kind of you see what's happening at Twitter, where there's this sense that focusing on people is a bad management technique and you should just be focused on results. But the funny thing, as we see the shift, is like even in this decade where there was a ton of people orientation, even then, I think that the mentorship piece wasn't really coming together either. And so I do think there's something for us to reflect on, where I do think the intentions of the last kind of decade and a lot of the ideas were very good. Still, the execution wasn't exceptionally good either in terms of actually fostering managers, even though the, I think, intention was there.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. That makes a lot of sense to me.
And what I'm seeing here is as you grow the company, you face an interesting challenge. Is either you find, you make a combination of decisions, hiring someone that could manage the new people that are coming in, and promoting people or trying to promote people or trying to promote engineers to a more leadership role. And I think I am more partial towards promoting. And the reason is, even though it's way more, I really see a lot of value spending hours talking about the philosophy we have in the company, how we do things, what are the core principles that we follow, the first principles that we follow, why those principles, how those principles are expressed in, like, let's say, hey, let's answer this email together, so you can see how I go about it, so you can see the first principles applied, or how we solve this technical problem, how we think about these things. And I I really, although it's way more laborious for me, I really prefer that part. Because I can see how my company, our company, is growing in a way that everyone understands each other and is going and following the same values. Although I'm saying is like, okay, let's not hire. I mean, I think here's a combination of things here that we have to make a balance in order to scale. So my question is, do you have any specific advice about that balance, how to strike that balance?
I think, you know, people are going to give you rules. Like, I love rules. They're like, they're always wrong, but they're like interesting to apply and see like what it tells you. And so I think a rule that I often hear is you kind of want like a mix in a rapidly growing company. You want kind of like a 50-50 split between folks internally who are kind of raising to larger roles and the folks externally who come in. But I think the context of like rapidly growing companies is really important there. So in a rapidly growing company, thinking back to my time at Stripe or at Uber, I think the challenge is the team gets a lot larger pretty quickly. And so the team I led at Uber went from, you know, literally 5 to 70 in 2 years. And so it's hard to like foster people at that pace because you don't get to see the same problem twice. It's like a new problem every few months. So it's hard to learn and improve. So there's like a desire to kind of bring in folks who have seen the problems before. But there's a lot of risk there as well. And so that where I've really focused is I do think that the mix is valuable. There are every external leader is like a meaningful risk for you because external leaders, I think good ones come in, listen and like add, bad ones come in and try to replace, right? And everyone's seen bad engineering leaders who come in and there's like, you know, month one, they're like, these people are idiots here. Like they don't know how to do software. Like I'm going to fix it. And there's like, step one, huge migration. Step two, bring in some friends. Like step three, like push out the existing leadership structure. And like a year later, it's just like in shambles. And then it's like, it's because the previous people sucked that it's not working. There's not like a ton of self-awareness on it. I mean, the reality is being an executive doesn't really reward self-awareness because then you'd be responsible and accountable for like your underperformance instead of being able to blame someone else, right? So this is like the nightmare scenario, but as long as you're hiring folks instead of like hiring ahead of a function, you can usually like avoid getting on the nightmare scenario. And sometimes I just think bringing in people with an additive experience is so enriching. I've just seen leaders come in. I think particularly, you know, ML and AI is definitely the hype wave of 2023 right now. But bringing in leaders who have like real experience there, I think something I hear from a lot of deep ML leaders is the idea of maybe we don't need ML for this problem. And there's kind of the people who have tried to over-apply the tools before and have learned where it doesn't actually work. And so I've really valued folks like that who have the experience to say, like, this is the wrong solution to the kind of problem you're trying to solve. Don't use ML here, as opposed to the folks who are a little bit earlier on the curve and are like, ML can solve anything, can solve a lot of things, but it's not necessarily the best solution. So to me, bringing in folks who are like a little bit further on the curve and can actually bring that wisdom is incredibly valuable. But the flip side is if you hire too many folks of that perspective, like the internal team feels devalued and they feel like there's no ability for them. And to your earlier point, you lose the culture because you start kind of not having enough leadership folks who actually have that depth that haven't gone through all the emails together with you to like learn how to write them, right? So to me, the mix, the balance is really important. But I think it's usually a bad sign, in my opinion, if a leader does only one or the other. If you only hire internally or promote internally, it's often a sign that you're struggling to hire externally, which is like a bit of a flag. It's not always a bad thing, but it's often like concerning. Conversely, if you only hire externally, it means you like can't develop talent. So to me, it's the balance that is the sign of kind of the best executives.
Interesting. I like that. I also particularly like your comment in there about being an executive doesn't reward self-awareness. I think self-awareness is so important. I'm a big fan of it. but yeah, in senior positions, you know, it's especially coming in as an outside leader, that temptation to make this system mine in positive and negative ways is very strong, right? So I think that's really interesting. I'd like to ask you about the four states of a team. I found this part of An Elegant Puzzle really interesting. You describe four states of a team and the different solutions that you apply to progress from that state into the next one.
So this is something I wrote about, it's 2019. So I guess that's no longer last year. I guess that's like 4 years ago now. But I think something I saw quite frequently is that people negotiate for the wrong things and the wrong times, and particularly relevant to kind of the slope of the impact of the team. So a place you'll see this like very often, even in larger organizations, like an infrastructure organization, is there'll be no developer productivity, right? No one working on kind of developer tools, and the tests get unreliable, the build times get slow. You add three people and they're incredibly impactful. And then people draw the line where it's like, actually, probably half of our company should be working on dev tools. And you're like, well, that's like right from like that initial moment where you get like a ton of return on those early projects. But there is like an S curve here where it goes from kind of no impact, huge amount of impact, and then it kind of like flattens out on the other side, where for the next 6 months, you'll look like a genius if you actually put, you know, half of the eng team working on dev tools. But then in 12 months, the results are like pretty bad, because you've just captured all the low-hanging fruit and the remaining problems are challenging and not amenable to just like throwing a ton of capacity at them at a certain moment in time. And so this is to me like one of the four stages where you do need to add capacity at certain points. But if you add capacity at other points, you're going to overinvest and you're actually going to like kind of miss-solve the problem, even though it feels like you're making progress at the right time. So the four stages, as I've thought about them, are: one, first, you think about that, like having no dev tools team, or having a dev tools team with like one person, and they're only responding to pages when the CI/CD pipeline is failing or something like that. And so certainly, like in that case, when you're only doing kind of small tactical stuff, you can't do any project work, you should add some more people to it. At some point, you get to a place where you are treading water, like you're not making much progress, but you're saturating all the incoming requests. And then I think about the challenge there is, how do you reduce work in progress? Adding more people can work, but there's always going to be more work that shows up as you add more people. So to me, it's more about figuring out what not to do in order to finish pieces of work. And even if you just have like one big project, as long as that project actually has meaningful results. And so what's a good example? So a lot of companies have test pipelines or that are very flaky and fail a lot. And you could think of some different strategies here, but one strategy would be to just auto-disable tests so that the tests complete, even if there's some flaky tests. That's not a great strategy, but it's a strategy that would work. Another strategy would be to actually build a framework where you can identify where the flaky tests are and what's causing flakiness. So a common problem we had is subtle interactions. So we randomized the order tests would run in, but there were certain combinations that would cause failures if the tests ran the random kind of subset of tests or sequencing of tests happened to be in a certain order. It would cause the tests to fail because they would pollute state across them. And so a project you could do is like actually running like a very complicated, well, not very complicated, kind of an intensive solution that just like tried all the different combinations of sequences and figured out like which ones failed. And then you could just fix the issue of kind of state pollution across the test runs. If you save the time to actually do that and finish that, all the future test runs, you know, until you mess them up again, will just work. They'll no longer have this kind of underlying issue with state poisoning across tests. So I think if you look at a project like that and actually can protect the team to finish that project, all of a sudden you free up a bunch of time. And so this to me is the genius of like reducing work in progress. It's How do you find a couple of these projects that will actually significantly reduce the amount of burden or toil in the future and protect the team to finish them? And I think, you know, the role of leadership in that case is just to absorb the frustration of the team not being able to get to the stuff they're not getting to. And that's, you know, part of leadership is, I think, taking risks and being accountable for the risks. And I think these are the sorts of risks that you have to take, which is that you see a project that will free time up, temporarily annoy some other teams. If you have conviction, that's going to work. You have to take the risk. And so that gets you out of this treading water phase. By completing a few of these, you actually free up time. And this is not adding people. It's like adding actual technology work that is going to reduce kind of the incoming toil. And after that, once you get one of those, you get a little bit of freedom to do like two of those or three of those, because you start freeing up more and more time. And I think that's pretty beautiful state, that you eventually end up in theory, this place where you have like no incoming toil. I've never seen a team actually get to that state, right? Like there's always kind of like new sorts of toil coming in, but I think that's pretty powerful. And the very last state that I think some teams get to, I think of as like innovation, where I think creating space for teams to try new things. I think if you don't create space to innovate on techniques, you will eventually, fall behind. And I think this is like one of the things I was talking with a friend about recently is, if you look at the best practices of 2023 and the best practices of, you know, 2011, they're pretty different. And the toolkits we use to accomplish the goals are pretty different. And technology moves slowly on a like, you know, like quarter to quarter basis, but it moves very, very quickly as you look at like 5-year chunks, where I think if we don't give teams space to actually make investments and to try new things, I think the best example of this today is like the different tools like GitHub, Copilot or whatnot that are trying to use like AI to improve like writing software. I don't think they're like necessarily that good today, but there's going to be ways to use these tools that are really valuable. I'm not sure if we as a like a engineering leadership class know what those ways are yet, but we have to give enough room to experiment to actually learn. Otherwise, this team will over time become very inefficient, even if it is like doing an excellent job of running the things the way they happen to work today.
Absolutely. Yeah, I find those four states really interesting. And one of the things that is interesting to me about them to, you know, you have the falling behind stage where you generally are adding people, treading water, you talked about where you're reducing WIP, repaying debt, where you're adding in some time to pay down that technical debt, and then this innovation stage of adding Slack. So out of those four states, there's only one of them where the solution is to add more people, right? And I think the temptation of someone new to management is that it's always about, you know, increasing people. Not only do they perhaps get to build their empire a little bit as a new leader, the number of people reporting to them, but it's a little bit of a simple solution, right? But it's really only one of those times that's the most appropriate solution. And I think that's very powerful to point out in those phases.
I think the one thing I'd add to that observation is that I think a lot of times leaders look for ways to get stuck. And this is a little bit counterintuitive because you think leaders look for ways to get unstuck. But a lot of times leaders look for ways to get stuck that aren't their fault. And I think headcount requests are a great example of that, where it's like, hey, I would be making progress, but you haven't funded my team the way I need it to be. So you're making me stuck. I'm not responsible for the outcomes here. And I think that's just like not a very helpful perspective. It's not totally wrong ever. Like there's always like some element where more staffing probably would have some incremental value. But I think as leaders, we have to avoid getting caught up in this being afraid of accountability, and instead just try to actually make results. If you want to be in a situation where you're more worried about being accountable than you are about like having an impact with the team and the energy you have. I've never seen that end well, even though it seems like it's working in the zero sum perspective. It's a pretty sad place to spend your time.
Yeah, absolutely. And in the treading water phase, you talked about the importance of reducing WIP there, perhaps through improving developer tooling, It could also just be in just focusing on, you know, the highest priority items of new features development, for example. I think that's always an interesting challenge as a leader, because you sometimes have to convince your business counterparts, your product owners and product managers, as but also your technical team. You have to coach them through this transition from a personal view of productivity to a team view of productivity and, you know, throughput as measured by Kanban and things like that. And I think that's a very challenging aspect of engineering leadership, to help people understand that it's not necessarily about you as an individual being the most productive. It's about the team throughput and delivery of value to the customers. Do you have any thoughts on how you help someone through that transition?
So one metaphor I think about a lot is this idea of motion versus progress. And so I think if you're in a car, you're driving down the road and you like roll down the windows, it feels like you're going a lot faster because you can like feel the wind hitting you in the face. Your hair is flying around. You feel the sensation of motion, but you're not actually going any faster, right? And I think there's a lot of leadership decisions that are basically the same way, where you were going at one speed, you roll down the windows, now you feel like you're going faster, but you're not. And maybe you're going slower because there's actually more drag on the car, on the aerodynamics, right? And just so many decisions kind of fall into this bucket. And so I think one example I was talking with a few people about recently is like the classic, you're in a monolith and the people want to move to services. Okay. And so to move to services, you first need to figure out like how to decouple the software. You can actually do that in a monolith, right? You can find the interfaces without moving to services. You can actually like enforce them within a monolith. And in a lot of ways, like it's a lot easier to do this migration in a monolith before breaking out to the platform. But so often the platform teams will be like, oh, we're going here. We're going to get ahead of that. We're going to build the platform. Then all of a sudden the platform teams kind of abandon the monolith where all product development still happens, move to building out this new platform. And then they've actually split the efforts where there's no longer anyone helping like the modularity work necessary to get onto the platform. But for the platform teams, they've gone from this place where they're like working on modularity, working on like refactoring this really frustrating code base, to instead this like freedom to like build this new platform. It just feels so productive. You can spin up this like endpoint that's like technically a new service in like, 10 minutes. They're unleashed. They've accomplished so much. They're checking off all these like goals and their roadmap or whatever. But the business is still stuck on this monolith that's actually like degrading. Like the business is actually worse off than it was before. And I think these trade-offs happen all the time. And to me, this is ultimately like an executive leadership question, where I think you have to set the goals appropriately from the top down. Otherwise, you incentivize people to move quickly and rapidly in the local little areas. And they don't have the context to like understand the trade-offs, right? So I think this happens all the time. Incentives are really powerful things. And I think sometimes when we talk about management or whatever, we overthink like the technical incentives, like the promotions, the performance grades or whatever, but just like feeling progress is a huge incentive as well. And so I've seen a lot of teams, not even with the promise of a promotion, just like for the desire to feel productive, do things that are actually quite unhelpful for the broader company.
That's interesting. I like the metaphor of the windows down. Doesn't mean you're going faster a lot. You also kind of lead into an area I want to discuss too, which is a section of the book about systems surviving one magnitude of growth. And if I may, I'd like to just read a quick paragraph from there about that, which I have to say, by the way, I don't consider myself necessarily like a bibliophile person who I read a lot on Kindle as well as physical books. But this elegant puzzle, the copy I have at least, is the binding of this, the tactile feel of this book is, chef's kiss. So kudos to whoever did that. Definitely recommend getting that one in a paper copy if you can. But in any case, in this section about systems surviving one magnitude of growth, you say that if your company is designing systems to last one order of magnitude and is doubling every 6 months, then you'll have to re-implement every system twice every 3 years. This creates a great deal of risk. Almost every platform team is working on a critical scaling project and can also create a great deal of resource contention to finish these concurrent rewrites. That is a lot of change to, you know, look at re-implementing a system essentially twice every 3 years. If you're growing fast, even in an organization that maybe is not growing that fast, you're still talking about having to re-implement things every few years. So how do you balance the change involved in system rewrites with kind of the necessity of them? How, you know, how far in advance are you designing your system? You know, why do you only look at one? You know, is it possible to design for more than one order of magnitude of growth? I think that's going to be the tendency of an executive to say, perhaps, right, is why didn't you just design this to scale for, you know, several orders of magnitude instead of just one?
I think this is a great question. I think every company is a little bit different, is like the reality. So the first thing I'd say is that there are companies that are growing at the rate I described, and Uber was a company that grew at that rate. Stripe grew a little bit more slowly, and I think if you just think about the different products, right? Like Uber had a pulse going from like each phone on, there's a phone for the driver and a phone from the passenger back to the servers every 5 seconds. Stripe does not have this pulse, right? Like only when money is moving would you have like an API call going for the most part. So very different products that behave very, very differently. Also, you know, Uber fundamentally pretty distributed problem. Like each city can operate in isolation. There's no, virtually no rides happening across cities, and the kind of available drivers are in the context of one city. You know, Stripe, money is not something where it can be kind of eventually consistent. Like people have strong feelings about money showing up, and most of the money systems, there's a Stripe tier, but there's like an underlying like credit, like Visa or some such that you're calling into that is centrally kind of like architected as well. And so they're just like very different products. Calm also very different product. And so the first thing I'd say is like, it's hard to generalize, like all these products are very different. But then, okay, stepping to this order of magnitude piece, I think it's hard to see the future in a lot of cases. And a lot of the most valuable infrastructure changes in terms of reducing infrastructure cost or load or ease of scalability have meaningful product trade-offs. And so I think, for example, if you've ever had a product that was built on like a, you know, Postgres or MySQL, and then you have like an infrastructure engineer who's like, well, actually, we should be building on a distributed database of some sort. And the product doesn't work the same way anymore. Like that there are real meaningful product limitations in terms of the types of product experiences you can expose and the complexity of doing it. And I've seen so many companies make these infrastructure-driven decisions that significantly slow down their ability to improve the product. And it is challenging to make the right decisions there. And I think if you look at the most modern databases, they are trying to mask or hide this problem entirely. You look at like Spanner or whatnot, or some of the other Aurora or some of these other tools that they're really trying to allow product engineers to not understand or be implicated by the consequences of these distributed systems while they scale. This is, I think, incredibly important. And this is where I think some of the most impactful work will happen over the next, you know, few years. And already a lot of it has happened where you can get the scalability wins without having the product kind of trade-offs that come from many of the first or second generation solutions to these. So I think as the technology gets better, there are places where you can just like start higher up the stack and never get to the place where you have to do this rewrite to get better tooling. I think particularly when I wrote that, the maturity of cloud vendors was much earlier, where you were often getting on pretty low on the scalability. And then like Aurora didn't exist at that point or was like relatively new. Certainly in 2019, it did. But when I wrote that originally, which might've been 2016, I think it either didn't exist or was a very, very early piece of technology. So there's just this like curve. And as we get further and further, the advantages of get to the start in a higher place on that curve where we don't have to worry until you get to 10 million users or further and further down the scale. But once you get to kind of the top of the commodity solution, the commodity solutions are really good. Like some of the best distributed systems engineers in the world are working on Spanner, are working on like AWS Aurora, et cetera, CockroachDB. So once you get past that, like the only thing that's left is like product trade-offs where you actually have to like compromise like the way you can build your product to get like more scalability. And that's where you get into the situation that I was talking about there. If you try to go too far, the consequences to the product are often like too extreme for your company to be willing to pay. Digg tried to move in 2010 from Postgres to, or MySQL rather, to Cassandra. And Cassandra was very early at that point. And one of the challenges, of which there were many with the rewrite that they did, was trying to move to this early version of Cassandra, which radically reduced the types of offerings we could expose to our users in a high performance and cost efficient way. And so to me, it's just, that's the core of it. It's like, once you get past what commodity tools offer, that there are always going to be product implications to any sort of scalability wins. And they're often very hard to make sufficiently far in advance. You can get more than one magnitude of growth out of them.
I really like that. Now, you have mainly talked about the systems and the products, but what about the teams? How can engineering managers prepare their teams, their people, not only to survive, but to thrive during periods of rapid growth and change?
I think this is a good question and also like a challenging question to answer really, really directly. I think one of the things that's happening when a company is growing quickly is that, the processes are breaking. Because processes are always, so there's like systems that are designed, but typically you get like a good system out of the box, particularly now where you get like a good vendor, a good cloud solution, where even, Postgres RDS is like pretty good. It's not perfect, but it's pretty good. It can take you a long way. Process is different. Most process, you don't get a good solution out of the box. And I'm working on a third book, kind of trying to think of like, how do we have like better processes out of the box? But typically like a startup, instead of, you think about Postgres, RDS, great product, great default. Think about their performance management process this startup of like five people has. So they have this like amazing, effectively world-class database they get almost for free. And then they have this incredibly, informal kind of ad hoc performance management system that like someone with no management experience just kind of made up and handed to them. And so I think that the challenge is the people processes just start failing every little bit of growth, like from the very beginning. There's no way, or we haven't yet found a way where you can take advantage of kind of the aggregate wisdom of kind of leaders, people managers, et cetera, to have like better processes from the beginning. And so this is the core challenge where fast growing companies, things are just failing all the time. You have like a incident process that needs to get more and more advanced as your company grows, where early on it's just one or two people with all the context that of your five engineers just jump on and deal with every incident. Once you have 50 people, that doesn't work. And then how do you keep evolving that? But you have like an architecture review or a tech spec review or something, which, those have to be evolved continuously to make sure they don't become really constraining or too liberal. And so there's just like all these processes, performance management, that just keep breaking. And so I think that the thing that you have to help people come to appreciate, there's a great book like about finite and infinite games. And there's this idea that finite games are games with rules, games with a winner, and games with losers. Infinite games are games where ones where the participants decide on the rules, and the goal of an infinite game is to keep playing. And so I think school, sports, like many things growing up, teach us to take this idea that like most things are finite games. You're here, like, I want to get the right performance score. I need to get promoted. I need to, you know, get the headcount. But the reality is, like, growing companies, like, the game changes constantly. It really is like an infinite game. And so I think when you start thinking about winning, you've actually sort of like misunderstood what you're supposed to be doing. But I mean, I say that as a person who spent, you know, years of my career trying to win, and then the game would change and I'd be like, you know, like, who just screwed me over by changing the rules? Like, I should have been, you know, promoted or given a higher performance score, but you changed the rules. That's not fair. But that's just how companies work. It's not a criminal to change the rules. It's actually like fundamental to companies to keep changing the rules.
This is so amazing. I something that Erin and I we've been spending a lot of time lately is when we engage with a new client, we always, I mean, something that is so important is to make sure that the new client has a good onboarding process and has a good provisioning system so that the new developers that we bring in know exactly how to start, how to get familiar with the culture, the company, the tooling, and the security measures, policies that are going to be implemented in their machines. But the perspective that I am seeing now in our conversation with you is that if you know that you are in a rapid growth phase, then the onboarding process by itself should be seen more like a mentorship process. So as a rapid growth company, are you paying attention to the onboarding process so you can make it more like a mentorship process and reasoning about that? And that perspective, I really like that. So thank you for pushing me to think about those terms, because this is what actually happens when you're growing so rapidly, right? Interesting.
Well, so I want to talk about the a little bit of the downside, unfortunately, the opposite of growth. You know, we do see companies go through reorganizations and downsizing, and you know, as at the time of this recording, that's a little more commonly in the news than rapid growth, unfortunately. These things are cyclical, of course. What is your experience with running an engineering reorg or downsizing? How do you prevent loss of knowledge as well as, you know, how do you prevent killing the morale of the remaining team members?
I think your point about cyclical is exactly right. I effectively joined the eng industry in 2008, teaching English before that. And yeah, in 2008, I tried to join Yahoo, and they just kept having layoffs. And so I get kind of the offer, I like accept it. And they're like, well, actually, we're frozen again on headcount. And so it took me, I think, like 5 or 6 months to actually get hired, even though I kept getting the offer, and then kind of like, well, actually, it's frozen again. And so finally you got in. But during, you know, like 2.5 year period, like the 6 months before I started and through the kind of the 2 years that I was there, I think there were either 4 or 5 rounds of layoffs at Yahoo. And they were big. They were like significant layoffs. I think Yahoo was 13,000 people when I joined, and like less than 10,000 when I left. And so then, you know, went to Digg, and I think Digg also had 3 rounds of layoffs in that 2 year cycle. And then, you know, layoffs to a large extent kind of disappeared in the tech industry for, you know, like close to a decade, as just money got more available. That's kind of the general expectations of like margin and revenue growth and profitability, et cetera, just like shifted in the industry. And now, you know, the last 3 years since the pandemic hit, it started rather, it it's just been, you know, back to the chaos. And some companies kind of having amazing 2020s and then really rough recoveries. Some companies just having bad 2020s and never kind of recovering from that. Some companies that raised at really high valuations and are now kind of stuck by those valuations and trying to figure out like how to handle that, whether they do a down round and disappoint all the internal teams, et cetera. I think like the reality in my experience is they talk about preventing kind of loss of context and knowledge. You're going to have like loss of context and knowledge is my experience. And I think that the things that I focused on, and Calm did have like a reduction in force as well last year, is just thinking about why are people here at the company? Like what is important to them, and helping like reaffirm like that those reasons still make sense. And I think that the challenge that for a lot of folks in the tech industry I've seen is they have this narrative about how much money they have like locked up in kind of the company compensation. And they're really upset about where they are, but they also feel like they'll lose this like kind of dream, you know, wealth if they leave. And so I think to me, the goal of leadership has to be helping people not get in that trap, but instead understand the value of being at the company and like the connection to the mission, the compensation as it actually exists in like the current state, the teams and kind of the inherent like value of the work in terms of like being development, being like growth work for them individually. I think the thing you can't do is just assume that the thing that kept them there 2 years ago or the year before kind of the layoffs or whatever is just going to obviously translate. I think you have to help them like find a way to like reaffirm that this is like the right situation for them. And I think it can't just be that the industry is really hard to get hired in, because that's not like a way that people are going to feel like energized and valued. And so to me, it's just like helping each person rediscover their reason why they are at the company. Otherwise, they're just going to be unhappy and, you know, reasonably so, that no one wants to feel trapped. And I think a lot of people feel trapped in these changeovers. Honestly, that's the biggest one that I've seen. I think the other piece I'd say is that I'm a big believer in this idea of like organizational math, by which I mean team should be roughly 6 to 8 people. Each manager should have roughly 6 to 8 direct reports. Each manager of managers should have roughly like 4 to 6 direct reports and so on. From that, you can kind of pretty quickly just do some org math to figure out if your org is like misbalanced or not. And then I do think that I've seen, you know, a lot of companies where a number of teams are just like undersized relative to their mission. And I do think you have to do some consolidation after that. Otherwise, you just have a bunch of teams that are understaffed, end up only doing kind of toil or kind of like keeping the lights on as opposed to any sort of like more like enriching work. And then you have this like long tail of kind of things continuing to kind of fall apart as people get frustrated and burn out and quit or whatnot. So I do think that, you know, helping each person understand their new reason for why they're actually at this job and just making sure the organization still makes sense after you've done the reduction. I think it's easy to just not kind of do that because it creates a little bit more change. But if you do it at the same time and kind of get the pieces like shoved through, and then it's like one moment of loss, not two.
Yeah, I appreciate that perspective a lot, and it reinforces, I think, a concept you described earlier of the infinite game of management. Really, that, you know, it applies to why someone joined the company a couple of years ago, may or may not, you know, the rules have changed for them of why they might stay now, why they might leave, and being aware of that as their leader, as their mentor, I think is proven through these times. I want to, we're starting to run out of time, unfortunately, which is too bad because there's so much more that we could cover. There is one particular area I want to cover briefly before we end, and then David, if you have anything else you want to cover after that. But most of what we discussed kind of falls under the traditional engineering management path. And certainly as I became an engineering manager, I only thought about there being one path. You know, the end goal was moving from being a developer to maybe at the end of my career being a VP, a CTO, a CEO, right? A very management role where you eventually take your hands off of coding entirely. But in your book, Staff Engineer, you talk about the staff plus roles and the path for advancement for people who don't want to take their hands away from the code or the technical problem solving, but still need a path for advancement. And maybe their end goal is a principal engineer, a distinguished engineer type of title. I'd love to hear you talk a little bit more about that staff plus career path, and also for companies who are new to those role descriptions, how do you start to implement a path like that for your engineering team?
Yeah, absolutely. And this book really came out of like a pretty concrete problem I was observing in the industry at that point, where there are these like staff engineer titles or distinguished engineer titles, but there wasn't much understanding of what they meant. And I think people who wanted to do like one specific thing that wasn't working, and I wanted to really push on this idea. And so the thing that I saw a lot is someone who's a senior engineer, they're like, I don't like working with other people. I just want to put my head down and write software. And I want to get promoted for it. And I want to get paid more for it. And I want there to be kind of uncapped growth for me personally, but I don't want to work with other people. I just want to be really productive. And the thing I really wanted to emphasize with this idea is that there are very meaningful growth paths for people to be non-managers and have huge impact on companies, but they don't look that way. And so what I wanted people to understand is that if they want to continue going forward, it's not just being a more senior engineer who puts their head down and does the work that they find the most energizing and fun. It's like usually people problems in different forms, and they're not managerial problems. It's not giving out performance ratings. It's not running a calibration. It's not, you know, figuring out an org structure, but they are fundamentally people problems. So a good example, we talked about changing infrastructure and how if you change the kind of the interface exposed by moving from my Postgres RDS to an early Cassandra, you can't build the same products. And so like a real problem a staff engineer might work on is infrastructure wants to move to this more scalable database. Product wants to ship products and can't build the products they think they need on that database. What do you do? And so that is a technical problem, but it's also like a deeply people centric problem as well. And there's no way to do it by just solving it without talking to people. That's not the feasible path forward. And so when, you know, I'm like the head of engineering at a company, it's very rarely that something escalates to me where the problem is we just need a faster engineer. That's like almost never the problem that kind of gets to me. That's like a pretty straightforward problem that can be solved like elsewhere in the organization. The problem that gets to me is almost always product engineering and infrastructure engineering disagree on their vision of the future, and they need someone to help like figure that out. And this is where staff engineers and folks in these roles are uniquely valuable, figuring out what is the actual right technical path forward based on all these real constraints we have from all these teams trying to accomplish their work. And so to me, that was the message I wanted to like write as clearly as possible, is that these are the problems that are creating real challenges for businesses and executives, and this is where they need help. If you want to continue advancing in your career, these are the shapes of problems that you need to start taking on. You're not going to keep getting promoted and paid more and viewed as more valuable if you just want to be heads down and write more code more quickly. That's actually not the problem companies have, and companies pay you for solving the problems they have. I'll put like one quick asterisk is I think there are a small number of companies that are doing like deep technical work that need industry leading domain experts. I think that's true. I think some machine learning oriented companies do need like a deep ML expert. I think there's a small number of companies building, you know, physical products. I think, you know, some of like the metaverse style stuff where there is like a real intersection between the technology the product, the infrastructure. But these are like very rare and very uncommon. And again, there's a difference between being more productive as an engineer and having unique, specialized knowledge in something. These people aren't just like faster. They might even be like slow or like mediocre software engineers in terms of just like writing product code or something like that. But they have like unique, special context about a specific domain, where in a company that actually needs that, they're extremely valuable. But I think people gotten caught up in companies as like a vehicle to reward them, as opposed to understanding that like companies value those who come in to solve the problems the company needs help with. And that's like ultimately how you get promoted, not because the company wants to reward you with more money or something like that.
It is common for me to find people that are fit in that description that you just said, is that I deserve a better compensation just for the fact that I have gray hair, and the conversation is never about the value or the impact they are actually giving to the company. And one of the biggest takeaways I'm having from this episode, if you will, is that by having these engineers, these technical people, to think about the importance to develop communication skills, collaboration skills, and strategic thinking related to the business value they provide, that will allow them to actually increase the impact and still thinking technically deeply in their day-to-day activities. And that is a very valid and effective way to grow in a company.
Most companies have this idea of like a terminal level, where like if you get to a level like senior engineer, you never have to be promoted again. This is kind of a big company concept. Like smaller companies usually don't have this idea at all. But at bigger companies, you'll get, if you don't get promoted to senior engineer by 7 years into your career or whatever, like they'll fire you for like lack of trajectory in your career or whatnot. Smaller companies usually, I think, much more flexible, much less like opinionated on this. It's like, are you doing a good job at the level you're at or whatnot? And so to me, you find these like terminal levels, like senior engineer, that's a job. That's a specific job. That's a really valuable job. I think most companies are basically built by their senior engineers. Like these are talented people doing incredibly valuable work. But to move into management is just a different job. And to move into staff engineering is also like fundamentally a different job. And so I think that's the thing I want people to take away, is that it's not just doing more of what they're doing. It's like fundamentally a different job that has different work that'll be rewarded and different challenges. And I think, you know, this gets tricky to talk about, because some companies use staff engineer as their senior engineer level, and it's just that the titles are just like used differently. So there's always confusion there. But specifically, that's the biggest thing I want people to like appreciate, is that these are different jobs with different challenges, and that will reward like different behaviors. It's not just being better at what you were before. Growing your career is often doing different work. That's a hard trade-off to make.
Thank you so much. Well, we're going to have to end there, unfortunately, but this has been a fantastic conversation. We really appreciate you sharing your time and expertise with us. For our listeners, make sure you check out Will Larson's books, An Elegant Puzzle and Staff Engineer. And sounds like perhaps more to come as well. Will, where can our listeners go to learn more about your work?
Yeah, so easiest place is just my website. I run my blog, Irrational Exuberance, and that's at lethain.com.
Wonderful. Thanks so much for your time, Will. Really enjoyed it.
Thanks for joining us on the Scaling Tech Podcast, where we help you manage your growing engineering team. Brought to you by agilityfeet.com, experts in staffing engineering teams in Latin America for clients globally. For more information on today's episode and to submit your ideas for future guests, please visit scalingtechpod.com.